I'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Dean has looked very carefully at the minutes. And Representative Dean, do you have a motion to make?
Move the minutes.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And the first thing on the agenda is public testimony on the governor's supplemental budget from Mary Krinke. There she is.
Thank you for your patience. You've come a couple times. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm passing out a page from the governor's budget. It's on page 161 and 162. This is in the revised budget. And I know we've had several comments on the GAMC proposal, but there are a few more points that I don't think have quite been raised that I would like to share with the committee members. I'd like to just read a line in this and then talk about the impact to hospitals. This proposal creates a capped hospital uncompensated care pool that covers some of the emergency room and inpatient costs incurred by hospitals for GAMC enrollees, while allowing the state to claim all disproportionate share hospital payments and medical assistance. And I'd like to make just three quick points this evening for you all. This capped uncompensated care pool covering some of the costs. What happened on the Senate side when they took public testimony and when the department testified, they said on the record that this proposal would undoubtedly raise uncompensated care costs for hospitals. And if you look at the back of this sheet and you look at the line where it says eliminate GAMC as an entitlement, and then it shows in parentheses the amount of money they're estimating in savings, the department, in essence, is saying that the hospitals will be on the hook for this huge growth in uncompensated care. If you look at how much money they're putting into the uncompensated care pool and compare that to the amount of money they're estimating in savings, it is a big, big difference. You can look at the amount for both the 10-11 biennium as well as the 12-13 biennium. Now, they are putting some money into outpatient services, but it's a question of, do you think this population can actually move into outpatient services away from inpatient services? And this is a very tricky population. Just as a reminder to folks, people on GAMC make less than $7,800 a year. That's how they're enrolled in the program. Most of the folks in the program have chronic health care diseases, so they're dealing with ongoing health issues on a regular basis. And taking this population and trying to move them to outpatient services only is going to be a very difficult task. And that is why the department said they thought that this proposal would greatly add to uncompensated care. We are very skeptical, and the line that I like to use, it's very hard to develop a health care home for someone who doesn't have a home. So it's a very tricky population to try to take care of their health care needs. The second point that I'd like to make that was in testimony the other day was that several hospitals said that GAMC was important for the metro hospitals. I just would like to go on record and say that GAMC is also very important to our rural hospitals as well. It only takes one or two very expensive cases a year, and it could be very devastating to a small rural hospital if they don't have a way to get payment for that. So if you stop and think about how this uncompensated care, charity care pool would work, a pot of money would be made available. So if you submitted your bills in January, would your bill be paid? But you submitted your bill in September, it would not be paid? Or would you get a percentage of the payment right away and then have a settle up at the end of the year? Well, GAMC and Medicaid, while they're not our best payers, they're certainly timely payers. So the idea of hospitals being out on the hook for that period of time until we had the settle up is very problematic. And the last point that I want to make and the final point, the department is keeping from GAMC payments to hospitals so they can leverage the federal dish money, which they themselves are proposing to keep. This is very problematic for hospitals, and you have to really look at the fine print of what the governor is proposing. But in the 2002 Medicare drug bill, there was new dish money available for hospitals, but the states had to put up a match. And our match that we're using right now is the Fee-for-Service General Assistance Medical Assistance Care Program. And we're using that as how we're leveraging dish money back to Minnesota, and that money is added to our quarterly payments to hospitals. So in the governor's budget, he's proposing to keep all the new dish money, and they're maintaining this inpatient GAMC portion so that they will have enough money to leverage the money back for the department. So the Hospital Association, once again, is on record, want to go on record saying, we believe disproportionate share hospital payments need to stay as payments to hospitals. So those are the 3 points, Mr. Chairman, and I could be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Krinke or the Hospital Association? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
And okay. So I'm going to turn it over to welcome to the committee. Pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair. I would move that the House file 2148 be heard and then laid over for possible inclusion in the bill. And Mr. Chairman and members, this is an idea that came to me, and then I asked the Department of Human Services to draft something, and we do have Mr. Held from the department here to answer the detailed questions, but basically this is an attempt to save rebasing, and what this bill does is, you know, as you may know, the governor has eliminated rebasing for nursing homes in his bill. This is an attempt to not to completely eliminate rebasing, but do it in a somewhat different way. And currently, rebasing is based on the cost to provide care in a nursing home. And that's how you set the rebasing. One of the problems there is, depending on the percentage of Medicare patients you have, the cost is can be different, because Medicare pays at a much higher rate than medical assistance. So what this bill does is decrease the, and some nursing homes do a lot of Medicare business, some don't do that much, and so there's a sort of an inequity in there. And what this bill does is try to adjust for that, and since what we're really trying to do is set the rates for medical assistance, this says we should just use the medical assistance rates as the cost of providing care, and we do the adjustment based on that. And to my understanding, we multiply the Medicare cost by 70%, so that we reduce them down to about what medical assistance pays. And there is a fiscal note that I don't have a copy of yet, but
yeah, it's solid. I think we do a pass out to it. He's got one.
So, as you can see, this does save some money, not as much as we had hoped, but there is a savings, and this is an attempt to protect rebasing. And if you have questions, Mr. Held is here.
And, Mr. Chair, I have a question. and so the savings is on just reducing the part that's allocable, so we just take the Medicare part out of it, and so that's smaller pieces of where the savings. Yeah. So nobody gets more money, just somebody gets less money. I'll ask Mr. Held.
I can let Mr. Held explain it.
Hello, Mr. Held. Chair, I'm the Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. What the language does is we don't actually know what Medicare's direct costs are, we don't have a precise split between Medicare costs and all other costs or Medicaid and private pay costs. And so, but we know that Medicare's rates are more than twice as high as Medicaid rates, and that the costs of a Medicare person are higher on a case mix adjusted basis than the costs of a Medicaid person. So, what this does is it estimates what Medicare costs are based on a couple things. One is that we know that part of the Medicare rate is associated with property. And we estimate that that's 12%. And of the remaining part, it would be operating, and we estimate 80% of that is the cost. So the 80% times 88% gives you 70.4%, which is what's in the bill. According to MedPAC, nursing facilities getting Medicare payment, this is a national average, they're margin is 13.1%. So we're assuming the margin is actually 20% and allowing them to have a higher level of confidence that they'd be retaining any Medicare profits, that you wouldn't be taking that away. The formula that comes up with the rate simply takes cost divided by resident days, and that equals the rate. What this does is it takes the Medicare cost out from the numerator, takes the Medicare days out from the denominator, and comes up with the rates that way.
So, Mr. Held, then this wouldn't give any more money to anybody. It would just take money away from those who had a higher Medicare percentage. Is that the idea? There would be no, there's no winners. There's just some go down.
Well, we were struggling with that fiscal note today, and actually discovered that about 50 facilities would get rate increases under this language. About 10 facilities would have no effect at all, and that leaves about 320 facilities that would get rate reductions anywhere from a nickel up to quite a high amount.
And those who get a rate increase are those with a very low percentage of Medicare?
We weren't able to examine the data and figure out what distinguished those facilities.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, Mr. Held, what is the range within the 300 and some facilities of Medicare? You know, you hear the number 70% quite a bit, and I'm just curious, what is that range for the facilities in total? Is it in terms of how many Medicare patients are folks on public pay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the 70% you're referring to actually, I think, is in reference to Medicaid, not mm-hmm. Medicare. The statewide average is 59% of resident days are paid by Medicaid, and about 8 or 9% are paid by Medicare. There are many facilities that don't have any Medicare that, in fact, aren't certified for it because they're board and care facilities, which aren't eligible, would be a small number. And then many facilities have a very small percentage, just, you know, 1-3%, and there's a very small number of facilities where almost all of the days are Medicare covered.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up to your line of questioning, Mr. Held, you said you were working on the fiscal note, and there's a distribution of maybe some increases and some rate decreases, but you weren't able to do that analysis. Will you be able to do that analysis and get us that information about that distribution?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we can certainly look at those facilities and try to tease out what their characteristics are. I'm not, from having looked at the list, I'm not confident that there's any real obvious feature that would jump out. I mean, we look to see, well, are some of these groups hospital attached or not, and the one piece that seemed very evident was that the larger Medicaid rate reductions occurred for the facilities that had almost no Medicaid. You know, there were two facilities that I was particularly cognizant of that were up in that end of the list. One is called the Colony in Eden Prairie. It's almost entirely Medicare, so this would have a huge effect on their Medicaid rate, but it would have very little effect on their bottom line. And the other was the Fairview University facility.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing, you start to tamper with any of these rates, they're so disparate and so many pieces, and even the experts have a hard time. Anyway, yeah, let's send them broad.
I'm sorry, I just have one more question, Mr. Held. Does this have any impact on equalization at all? Or could this?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, it would, in the sense that a facility that has a rate reduction under this, or gets a rate increase that's smaller than it would otherwise be, or that gets a rate increase, that would become their desk rate, the rate that's issued to them by the department, and for non-single bedrooms, that would be the rate that they would be allowed to charge to private pay residents under rate equalization.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so, Mr. Held, would that be taken into account in the fiscal assessment as well? I'm just curious. If they aren't allowed to charge their private pay, it's almost like a double hit. Is that a fair statement, or am I confused?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, when we do the fiscal note, what we're giving you is an estimate of the effect of the language, if it were enacted, on the general fund, the state's general fund. It does not do an estimate of the impact on the facility itself. And so the effect that they would experience related to private pay could, in the long run, if it was substantial, have an effect on the state, because it could either speed up or slow down the individual's spend down to becoming Medicaid eligible, and we did not take that into consideration.
Just to follow up then, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Held, how many of our nursing facilities are held by public entities versus private entities? Do you have any idea?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Broad, I believe that about 60 facilities are governmentally owned.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Held, Representative Huntley, too, I'm wondering if it might be worthwhile to try to understand the local and request a local impact on this, too. I'm just trying to think of all the components of it. I know it's difficult and it's complex, and I'm not sure I understand all the pieces of the moving parts, but if 60 of them are held by public entities, it seems to me that there might be a local impact that ought to be considered as we go forward. So just to throw that out there, thanks.
Make your job even harder, Mr. Held. Can you just comment while you're
here?
Oh, yeah, we're just here to help you. Can you comment with the rebasing proposal that's there that was going forward? Do they just all go up at their own? The rate disparities remain in rebasing, or do they get flattened out in the original bill but sans this change?
Mr. Chair, our analysis of rebasing was that it would reduce the disparity between a facility's rates and that facility's costs, but that the effect on actual rate disparities, the rates that a facility would receive under rebasing would depend on their costs. And so if they altered their costs as rebasing goes into effect, then their rates would be affected by that, either up or down. So there's no way to predict how facilities will spend in 5 or 6 or 8 years and what the effect on that of rates, and then how that would affect disparities. But assuming that if you set aside that assumption, I believe our analysis showed that the effect on rate disparities of rebasing was fairly small, but it would actually increase those, is my recollection.
It's like the weatherman sometimes.
I hope I'm right more often than the weatherman.
Any other questions for Mr. Held? There's some people I want to testify to, right? Thank you for coming down, Mr. Held.
Thank you.
Who's coming down? I think there's two people testifying. Mr. Bostic and Jeff and Mr. Bergstrom. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and
thank you.
Offer your thoughts.
Mr. Chair, my name is Todd Bergstrom. I'm the Director of Research and Payment for Care Providers in Minnesota. And what we'd like to do is just discuss some of our concerns regarding this proposal. As all of you know, in 2007, the legislature passed the rebasing of nursing facility operating rates. And the intention of that was to address, well, two things. The first being that we have seen over the last 10 years a growth in what the actual rates are and what the actual cost of care is. And that number projected for 2008 is roughly $23. The other issue that we are trying to address is to build in some predictability into how the state manages and pays nursing facilities. Because as right now, it's very difficult to look beyond the next year if you're in, operating a nursing facility. So last October 1, 2008, we began the first step, kind of a small step, towards the eight-year phase-in of addressing those problems, which is to match the cost of care with the rate. And what House File 2148 does is it fundamentally changes some of the assumptions about how we are going to address that problem. And what it does, as Mr. Held noted before, is that allowable operating costs, as defined in statute, are reduced by 70.4% of the Medicare revenue from Part A and Part B. So according to our estimates, assuming a full phase-in of this proposal, so if we could speed forward to 2015, in 2008 dollars, that would reduce revenue within the rates by about $42 million, or roughly 3%. And I think, as Mr. Held noted, there is quite a variance. This is anywhere from 0% increase for some facilities all the way up to quite a bit larger of a decrease. So what we'd like to do with Mr. Bostic right next to me is go over some of our more specific concerns. And the first one actually deals with Medicare. And that is, right now, in long-term care for nursing facilities, the margins from Medicare are used to offset the underfunding of Medicaid and private pay rates. And I guess one of our more specific issues is the 70.4%, while a global number really doesn't address the specific facility operations. So, for example, if you want to think of it this way, we know that more than half the facilities in the state have negative operating margins. So it's pretty safe to assume that they're using all their revenue is covering all their costs, and this is actually taking away some of those allowable costs. I'd like to turn it over to Jeff Bostic.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. I'm Jeff Bostic with Aging Services in Minnesota. I want to pick up where Todd was and go back to a little bit of a point that was made earlier about what the bill actually does. It takes Medicare revenues out of the calculation of the rate, and it assumes that you're taking costs out of the rate. And the difference is there is no way, as Bob mentioned earlier, there is no way to identify exactly what cost is related to what resident. What facilities do under rebasing and under a cost-based system is they report their costs, and it's turned into a per diem based on how many resident days they have related to those costs. And the cost is just related to money that you have to spend to provide care to residents. Your revenue comes from a variety of sources. The bill assumes that because Medicare is a higher payer, that you have a lot of Medicare revenue, and therefore it's distorting the rates, so we'll take out the Medicare revenue and balance it out. But because you're not actually taking out costs related to Medicare residents, in effect, in reality, what you're doing, at least in some cases, is you're taking costs out of the rates that are probably being used for the benefit of Medicaid residents. There's just no way to tell. The money comes into one bucket, and then you turn it into a cost as you provide care to residents. So it's a bit arbitrary to claim that this, with this percentage, that we've hit on a way to remove Medicare from the rate. So a follow-up point to that is that there, if we want to look at a way of just identifying the cost of caring for the Medicaid residents, that we probably need to do some more work on how you would do that. There may be approaches that other states use to do this, and there may be a way to identify more directly the actual costs of caring for each resident, so you know when you're taking money out of the rate calculation that you're taking out money that's specifically related to Medicare and not just an estimate based on revenue. The other thing we'd like to note is that rebasing already represents to a significant extent less than what we had hoped to get. It has a very long phase-in period. It doesn't include any inflation of costs. So you're reporting costs back here in this time period. When rates are calculated, it's actually 2 years later, and that 2 years of inflation is essentially never recognized under the system that's in place, even if it were fully phased in. So this takes another step down the path of reducing costs from what they actually are in terms of what facilities are providing to residents. It's not a lot of money, but it's an additional 3% off of what facilities would get under rebasing, and ultimately it's a lot more than that for some facilities. As we pointed out, there's a great deal of variation. And the final thing we would point out about the bill is it doesn't, as you can see from the fiscal note, in the upcoming biennium where we're working to balance the budget as hard as we can, there's not a lot of money there because there's not a lot of rebasing that goes on in the next couple of years. So this is a policy that has some long-term implications for how rebasing works. It doesn't produce a lot of savings in the short run, and certainly something that I think requires a little bit more thought and study before we put a policy like this in place.
Do either of you have an idea about why the runs were so different? Mr. Held was kind of surprised by how that turned out by facility. Did you pick up any trends about who got hit harder than others on the negatives or on the positives? Either one of you.
I think the one larger trend has more to do with just how rebasing works, and that is we know the hospital attached facilities have higher limits and in many cases probably exceeded them. And so what you really saw is you saw a lot of freestanding, which are non-attached facilities, which had larger decreases. I think that's the one trend that I can point out with some certainty.
Yeah. And the big variable, obviously, would be the more Medicare you have, the more cost or more revenue that is being assumed to be cost is taken out of your rates under this proposal. So I would assume, we haven't shared numbers with the state on this, but I would assume they would match up relatively well, because that would be the biggest driver of what happens under the bill.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one thing a budget deficit does is sort of make you think more critically about how this payment stuff works, and we seem to be having lots of discussions about that across the system. So I'm wondering, Mr. Bostic, if you could just explain to me one more time how that works, because I think I heard, the money comes in from different sources and then it goes to provide care, but it's not really broken down patient by patient, resident by resident.
Right. To try and make it as simple as possible in a 30-second answer, but what facilities are reporting is their cost of caring for all of their residents. So all of your nursing, all of your food, all of those costs get reported and converted into a daily per diem, and then you run it through a formula, and ultimately you end up with a rate. The issue with this bill is that your costs are obviously to some extent related to your revenue, but it's very hard to take a dollar of revenue from Medicare or from Medicaid or from any other source and say that this dollar has been spent to benefit this resident. What this bill does is make some assumptions that because you're getting a lot of Medicare revenue, therefore you're spending that for Medicare residents, which is inflating your cost, which gives you a higher per diem, which gives you a higher Medicaid rate. But ultimately, by making this somewhat arbitrary adjustment, you don't know if you've taken out costs related to Medicare residents or costs related to other residents. Because when people are spending money to provide care, they're not tracking where the money came from to do that.
That's the mercy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bostic, thank you for that. Why do we use this method of payment? Why do we use this method, the method you just described?
Up to the panel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, this I, it's very fair to say this is the method that's used throughout the United States. I mean, in one form or another, whether it's a price-based or a cost-based system, all costs are factored in, and you place limits in there. Within rebasing, we have limits on direct care and other operating, and so in theory, you're limiting any, say, exposure to exorbitant costs that way, and not necessarily concerning yourself about the revenue, but the cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just advice to the testifiers, I'm just chair for the moment. I think Reps can help me without even having chatted about this. This is this committee has a target of $400 million to uncover. And I think just knowing the will of a lot of the members is they really like the rebasing that is still there in the base bill that the governor chose not to have. And this is a way to try to soft land some of that. And so just advice to you guys. You might want to look at the numbers that they generate here and try to find another way to get that that causes less pain to individual ones. And some people, if half, in my mind, if half the places are operating below cost, well, we surely don't want to hurt them. And we, knowing the ones who are above cost, aren't really getting rich. And that's the situation you're in. And I've sat here 11 years, and apparently sat here longer. And he and I and the rest of us are sympathetic to the plight you're in. Representative Fritz wants to offer it.
Thank you, Chairman Ebert. Well, for us out in greater Minnesota, I just wanted to add this, that, you know, in Faribault, where we have three nursing homes, we're fighting for those Medicare patients. So, you know, where I work, I may have 62 residents, and if I have four Medicare, that's a lot. So it's not as though we have a whole wing of Medicare people. We don't. And I just wanted you to be aware of that, that's how it really works out there.
And I think we also know that Medicaid pays, you can't make a living on Medicaid. And that's, it's just a, I shake my head yes, and even the weatherman here understands that, so, Mr. Held. So, other members with questions? Representative Huntley, do you want to?
I'll renew my motion that House File 2148 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Held over.
The next bill is House File 1032 with author is Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 1032, again, it's a self-advocacy program established for persons with developmental disabilities, and I have a couple of testifiers here with me this evening, if you'll give me the courtesy.
So, okay, well, Representative Fritz moves House File 1032 that it be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. And then I think you have an amendment.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. So Representative Fritz says the A1 amendment. Did you want to describe that? Or?
Yes, I will. This is the amendment that actually explains that there is not a fiscal note with this, that it's a transfer of money. I'm going to have
the amendment is shall seek replacing obtain as one amendment, and then the second amendment removing language between.
Could you state your name for the record?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, I'm Rick Hartnett, co-director, Advocating Change Together, Mr. Chair, and members. The amendment is to delete on line 1.2, to delete obtain and insert seek. So shall seek will be, that's one amendment. The second amendment is to delete everything after year. And 1.3, two lines, 21 match in 1.2.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, then Representative Fritz moves the amendment A1 to House File 1032. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. So we've adopted the amendment, and Representative Fritz, then we're back to you on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do have two testifiers here that I would like for you to hear from as well.
Hi, I'm
She's going to need to get right close to the microphone there. And
now can you hear me? I'm Katie McDermott, Mrs. Huntley, and the members of the committee. My name is Katie McDermott, and I'm a self-advocate and member of the Leadership Board Council of SAM Self-Advocate Minnesota. I am also a board member of ACT, Advocating Changes Together, and I work at Merit. I have only been a self-advocacy for over 3 years now, and it's made a big difference in my life. I am now very active in the community. Self-advocacy has given me a new self-confidence. I have been to the Capitol to ask legislators to support legislation of service to people with disabilities, and I am hoping to move out of my parents' home in the next couple of months. We need to get Metro SAM started with a 1032 bill. This can help more people become self-advocates and become stronger members of the community. Thank you all very much for listening to me.
Chair Hunley and members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to testify on House File 1032. I'm Rick Cardenas, and I'm the co-director at Advocating Change Together. And this is a disability group working on civil and human rights for persons with developmental disability across the state. We have been administrating the SAM project for 2 years. There are over 50 groups, some new and some existing, but we've been providing support for them for these 2 years. The SAM network has given persons with disabilities, developmental disabilities throughout the state, an opportunity to communicate with other members, other individuals with developmental disabilities in this network. We have five active regions, Northeast, Northwest, Southeast, Southwest, and Central. There is no Metro Self-Advocacy SAM at this point. Some of the accomplishments over these past couple of years has been a DVD that we've created called Offense Taken, which we've just passed out, and that's in regards to the use of the harmful and hurtful word retard, which seems to be gathering some attention right now. And so this video that we've created with the help of the SAM network has addressed that issue. Another example of SAM is the role we're playing in the self-advocacy conference that you have a piece on also. Over 550 people will be participating in that conference coming up, and not only there as a network, but most of the presenters in our over 40 workshops that over 2 days will be members of SAM and self-advocates. So by transferring this money from the Department of Administration, it will allow us to try to seek some federal matching funds for the funds that are already in the governor's budget. So we look forward to working with DHS and see if we can find some matching funds. And I think there was mention earlier that there was a fiscal note. Well, the fiscal note is zero on this. As a matter of fact, we had a meeting about that Friday, and if we went the route with the fiscal note to the administrative time study, we would have ended up owing you all money, and we don't want to do that. So we're going to try to find another way to get a federal match with that. So this transfer, we hope we can fulfill with this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Abler. I just have a question about the money. I don't know which one of you to ask. I'm familiar with the Council on Development of Disabilities, and are they don't need the money for anything else, and they're happy that this is something they would like you to do? Or are you just kind of helping them out to decide that this is a good idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, would you repeat that question? I don't think the transfer is...
Well, is the council in agreement with this?
The DD Council.
Right.
Mr. Chair, DD Council. Yes. Yes, indeed, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, the DD Council is participating in helping us to search for a way to do this transfer.
And Mr. Chair, and so you just need a law to make it happen, so is that all? Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? So I see none, so that Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 1032 as amended be recommended to pass and return to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Pass the sense of the Finance Committee. And the next bill on the agenda is 1830, which is my bill, and I've had a long discussion with the chair of the committee, and he won't give it a hearing, so we'll not hear that one today. Okay. So you want Scott? Yeah. Representative Scott is here with House File 1771, and is the next bill on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Representative Abler moves 1077, and is that 1771, rather, and this one is going to Finance, so it will be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Right.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. This bill is really just a help administratively re-administer child support, redirect child support. And excuse me, I didn't even know this was on my agenda for today. It wasn't on my calendar, so somebody got me out of committee. But what I think I'd like to do is let my testifier explain the bill in a little more depth.
Thank you, Representative Scott. My name is Mark Ponsol. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. In our office, I'm the Human Services Director responsible for child support enforcement. I'm also the chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Child Support Committee and the chair of the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council Legislative Committee. As you've heard, Representative Scott asked me to explain the bill. Currently, if the government's involved in child support, money is sent to a central payment system, which in turn sends the money to the parent where the child's living. That's how the process is right now. Sometimes where the child is living changes, and another person goes on public assistance who has the child now. There's a court order for the child to go to another person, or the child's in foster care pursuant to voluntary placement agreement. When this happens, child support continues to be sent to the person where the child formerly was. When the county hears of this, we try to seek consent to have the money follow the child. More often than not, we have to file a motion and request a hearing to get the court to order it. This bill would allow us to send the child support to the new caregiver after giving notice to all the parties and giving them an opportunity to object. So right now what we would have to do is file a motion, have a court hearing, and if everyone agrees, then the transfer of money would occur. This would allow us to do it after giving notice without having to set up the court hearing and file all the motions. Either way, everybody is notified, but it would be, if somebody wants a hearing, then they have a right to a hearing. Once we learn that the child is returned to the original caregiver, then we would once again give notice to everybody and then allow the money to flow back to where the original caregiver is. So in essence, the child support is following the child. Very briefly, there's a number of organizations that are supporting the bill. Minnesota Social Services Association, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Association of Minnesota Counties, the State Department of Human Services Child Support Enforcement Division, Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, Minnesota Inter-County Association, Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council, the Minnesota Fathers and Families Council, and ACME Council 5. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be more than willing to try to answer them.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, Ms. Heffler, I just wanted to make sure I'm clear. This is only for families or caregivers that are on public assistance that are going to be taking care of the children. Is that right, or is this much broader than that?
It's a little broader. It's in three cases. Once where the new caregiver is on public assistance. The second case would be where there's a court order transferring custody to a new caregiver but doesn't address where the child support would go. Mm-hmm. And the third area would be if a child is put in foster care pursuant to a voluntary placement agreement by one of the parents, then we would be able to move the money to the new caregiver. So it'd be those three instances.
What happens if for some reason you send out the notice, no one responds, you then redirect the child support, and you find out that that was done in error? Like, for instance, what if you sent the notice and the custodial parent, the person who had it, couldn't read the notice? They avoided it, they threw it away, they didn't know what it was, or they were unable to respond, and they still have the child, or they wanted to make some sort of claim. How would you handle that?
How we would do that now was, we, assuming they had the child, let's say you outlined a couple different instances. Let's assume that our information was wrong and they had the child. They had the child, they always had the child, and our information was wrong. Then we would immediately redirect the child support under this bill back to the custodial parent who's always had the child. If they did not receive the notice but they had an objection, then we would set it on for a hearing to allow them to register their objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reverend Scott, when we have new members and child support issues, we're always trying to kind of figure out what's happening there. And I know I did read in the legal ledger about father's rights being part of your interest. So I found that interesting, your training spill. I have visited with Mr. Puntel about this. Can you tell us how many cases a year are affected by this?
Thank you for asking that question, because we did just receive a preliminary cost analysis. And the state has done that, and they are estimating that in 2005 and 2008, there was an average of 1,100 cases where we obtained a court order for redirection.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. It's Puntel, right?
Correct.
Puntel. Is that primarily in the metro area, or do you have any kind of a split, how that splits out throughout the state?
I think... Thank you, Chairman Huntley. Chairman Huntley, Representative Slavik, I believe most of those would be in the metro area, but I haven't taken a survey sufficient to know exactly where they get the numbers.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. I know we had talked about this initially when you started carrying this bill. I know you came to me and had hoped that I would help you or be a co-author on it or something, and I had some concerns about it at that time, and I have to say I still have those same concerns. And one of them is this idea that the county can go ahead and redirect the payment, and it kind of falls to the person who's losing the payment to protest if they don't want that to happen. And that really troubles me, because kind of along the same lines that Representative Hayden was talking about, because of the, you know, and it's fine, they could get it back if they then, you know, oh my gosh, where'd my money go? But I think we might be talking here, correct me if I'm wrong, we're talking about some people who perhaps are living pretty close to the bottom, and for whom that child support payment, you know, might mean the difference between, say, paying their rent that month or not. And it bothers me that there doesn't have to be an affirmative indication on that person's part that they're okay with having that redirection. And you're kind of putting the onus on them to speak up if it's not the right thing. And I don't feel comfortable with that. I think that the potential benefit here, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the reason the policy reason behind doing this bill is to take some administrative burden off of counties, if I'm not mistaken. But the countervailing interest here, I think, is in the interest of that person who might possibly be losing the child support payment accidentally, and then have to have the wherewithal to figure out what happened to it and who they should protest to and all of that. So could you address that for me, please?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Ponsole, but if there was a request for redirection of child support now, they would be notified in the same manner, correct?
Correct.
So the notification process, the way it is now, is the same as it would be if this law were to pass, if the law were to pass.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. So what is this bill doing then? I mean, as I understand it, you might be notifying the same way, but what the bill is doing is saying, but okay, then you can go ahead and change the child support without that person affirmatively doing anything. Am I right? Or am I missing something?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think the difference here is just the right now you send out the notice and then you automatically have a hearing. This is just saying you still get the notice. If you don't respond, then there is no hearing.
Okay, well,
that's the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's why I'm going to vote no on your bill, because that bothers me.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question related to that third category, the foster care category, in terms of when a child severs that. I'm not really familiar with our entire foster care system, but I've always had the sense that there's various formulas as to how the payment for foster care is calculated. Money counts mostly from the county, and that it's based on some formula of the level of need of the child and special circumstances, all those kinds of things, and medical issues and all that. Here it sounds like we're taking child support payment and giving it to the foster family. I didn't even know that was even a possibility, first of all. But it seems like, I'm just wondering how we overlay our foster care system with this transfer of child support payment money. And that, would it necessarily reflect the same formula result that currently, that would occur in a normal foster care placement for a child like this? So it seems like an oddity. Yeah.
Mr. Bessel.
Chairman Huntley, Representative Bunn, I may have been unclear on that. The way the statute is written, caretaker can be a person or it could be the county. In the case of a voluntary placement agreement, the foster parent would still get foster parent rates. The way it's determined, the child support would go to the caretaker, which in that case would be the county.
Any other questions? Seeing none, all those, Representative Aber renews his motion that House File 1771 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
I think the ayes have it. So the bill is passed and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Okay, next is Representative Hayden. Where are they? I'll file 985. Representative Hayden moves that House File 985 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have an amendment, a delete all amendment. That we want to move that now. Or we want to move.
Representative Hayden moves the amendment DE1. You want to describe the amendment, or is it...
Well, essentially, the amendment is in some concerns about the bill that the counties had about their responsibility in making sure, or their financial responsibility in providing these services for foster care, young folks that are aging out of foster care, and their ability to work with them until they're at least 21 years old. So the DE1 amendment really just specifies that the counties are not mandated, is that right? The counties aren't mandated to do this work, but many of them are already doing it, and that they have to develop a plan in which to work with these young folks.
Okay, any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted the DE1 amendment, and Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 985 is amended as part of the Youth Moving Forward Ready to Launch initiative that are supported by a broad coalition of advocates and providers working on behalf of youth. This bill would allow youth who age out of foster care or run away from care after age 15 to come back to the youth-serving social service system for help if they need it. This option is currently only available to wards of the state. Each year in Minnesota, approximately 600 youth prepare to leave home for good. Because these youth have been removed from their families and have not been given permanent families, turning 18 can mean that they're truly on their own. Foster youth are no more ready for independence at age 18 than their non-foster care peers. 95% of Americans who are 25 or older before they are able to live are 25 or older before they're able to live self-sufficiently. Less than 10% of 18-year-olds live on their own. Recent estimates suggest that parents provide their young adult children with material assistance totaling approximately $38,000 after they reach 18. Parent time assisting their 18 to 34-year-old children averages 367 hours per year. That's 9 weeks of full-time help. 61% of college students receive financial support from their parents. These are our young people from whom we've accepted responsibility by removing them from their parents and placing them in care. We need to provide what all good parents provide, a place to return for help when things go wrong or expected support turn away. Today we have Mary Regan, who is going to kind of testify on the need, and we also have another testifier right after Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And as Representative Hayden indicated, this is one of the initiatives that's part of the Youth Moving Forward group of initiatives that we started with last year. And this all really began several years ago when some of our providers came forward with lots of concerns about what was happening to children as they were aging out of foster care or treatment programs, and finding that some of them were coming back and they were homeless, weren't able to get any help, didn't qualify for adult services. And so we put together a very broad group of stakeholders. We brought youth in, asked for input on what would be most helpful, and the things that they came up with are the things that we've been pursuing the last couple of years. Last year you passed a bill that required the court to take a look at what the provider and the worker and the child were doing to prepare for independent living, at every annual court review after the age of 15. So we started with ourselves in a sense. We said we need to be held accountable for what we're doing to help these children. This year we're back with two specific proposals, one to provide these children with automatic coverage under medical assistance up to the age of 21, and then the bill that we're hearing tonight, which would really give these children the opportunity to come back between the ages of 18 and 21 if they run into a crisis, which is basically what we know all of our kids do between those ages when they run into a crisis. But unfortunately, these kids don't have families to do that with. For the last 20 or so years, the federal government has really recognized that this is an important issue, and in 1986, they passed the Independent Living Program, allocated money to the states to provide services for these kids. Again, in 1999, they passed a new program and allocated more money. And then in 2008, President Bush signed into law the Fostering Connections to Success Act, which encouraged states to really start looking at this age group and required them to begin tracking outcomes for this group. One of the things that's been happening since 2002 is a research project that's gone on led by Chapin Hall out of the University of Chicago. And they have looked at three states in the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa, to see what happens to children when they age out of care. And in Illinois, children are encouraged to remain in care till the age of 21. So they've had a group of kids who stay in care to compare to the two other states where children are encouraged to leave at 18, as they are in Minnesota. And the outcomes are pretty significantly different. In Illinois, where they're encouraged to stay in care, they're two times as likely to have a high school diploma, twice as likely to be enrolled in school or a training program, three times as likely to be enrolled in college. Females in Illinois have a 38% reduction in the risk of pregnancy at age 19. And there's a very strong correlation between children who are young people who can remain in care and getting the independent living services they need to really know how to take care of themselves when they leave. A California study recently completed showed a return of $2.40 for every dollar spent caring for youth up to the age of 21. Good parents don't cease parenting when a child turns 18. We've assumed parenting responsibility for these children, and like all good parents, to be there for them when life happens. That's what we're asking for with this bill. Thank you.
Okay, next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Brewington. I'm a legislative liaison for Ramsey County, and I'm here today to offer support for the best practices promoted in House File 985, and we thank Representative Hayden for bringing this issue to the forefront. Ramsey County has, for several years, provided the services that this bill would urge the counties to provide. Under our current system, the services that we provide are paid for out of county dollars, and so there is language in the bill that addresses and gives counties some flexibility in providing these services. Ramsey County is unique in the way that we provide these services. We have two kind of options for kids as they age out. One of them is to allow them to remain in foster care, and the county pays the care provider room and board for the youth to remain in their home until age 21 if they choose to, provided that he or she is attending high school or post-secondary education. This costs the county about $1,000 a month. The second option is the offer of an independent living allowance, or ILA. The ILA is $203 per month if the youth elects to be emancipated and if they are attending post-secondary education. The young people who select the ILA live independently, but also are eligible to continue to receive case management services from Ramsey County. Ramsey County estimates that right now, on a rolling basis, throughout the year, we have about 100 foster kids that are continuing to receive services from us after they've aged out. And the total cost is somewhere around $150,000 a year for those kids. we look at this as a last or a final installment in a long-term investment, as these kids, as they cross this bridge into adulthood and independence, they're very vulnerable to becoming engaged in criminal activity or becoming victims themselves. Many of them become homeless or are at risk for that, at least. And there is a severe shortage of beds in the Twin Cities and throughout the state for unaccompanied youth, and it's always easier to keep somebody in housing than it is to provide for them when they're homeless and try to get them into something. So we do see this as something as best practice, and we have found and we believe that we see savings across some of our other departments and corrections and in some of the other family support areas by helping these kids as they make that final move into independence. And I stand for any questions.
Well, a personal comment first. Sometimes they come back home when they're nearly 30.
I know.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, to our first testifier, the issue of the Chicago study, and it dovetails with our second testimony, in terms of the good results when they stay in care to 21, I assume you mean the type of care where they remained at home, not just services, which is being talked about in this current bill. I just want to be clear about the current bill is just talking about them not remaining in the home, but receiving services from the county and various other ways. And I want to be clear that the Chicago one, they either stayed home or were closely tied. They may have been college, but still really part of that family unit until age 21. Whereas here we're talking about primarily a plan and some additional services, which is complicated by the Ramsey County story because they're already doing even the stay-at-home option. And so I'll throw out my second question as well is to the individual from Ramsey here, County here, which is why the huge differential? Like you're getting $1,000 per month for room and board to keep them in the foster family. Now you're trying to heavily incentivize them to stay there, but then only $203 a month, which seems very, very small amount that wouldn't nearly cover their room and board anyplace else or on their own apartment for them to, if they stretch out on their own. So those are the two questions, one for each of you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn. Well, actually, what the bill asks for is for the county to develop a plan, and part of what was put in the statute last year was that they have to notify a child 6 months before they're 18 that they may have the option to remain in care. Without some encouragement, without some recognition of what that really means, many kids at 18, even of our own, say, I'm ready to go, I'm out of here, I can make it on my own. And so recognizing that doesn't happen as often as it might, what we're really looking at with this bill is, okay, they left, but now they realize it's not as easy as they thought. So the bill also suggests that the county must ensure that any foster care housing or counseling benefits are tied to that plan. So it is addressing the option to come back for counseling. The amendment says to the extent funds are available, so it gives that flexibility.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not familiar with all of the policies and why there's such a differential from those kids that stay in home versus those that are given the independent living allowance, except that not every foster child is in a home where they want to continue caring for that child. So that option's not available to all of the kids. And those where it is, it's great to be able to keep them there and continue them. Some of the kids are out on their own because they left early or because they want to be independent, and as Mary indicated, that it becomes a difficulty and they discover that once they get out there, just like our kids that come back at age 30. So the ILA, if I'm understanding it right, is a stipend that we can provide to them in addition to perhaps offering them some other services that they may be eligible for. The case management that comes with this, I think, is very important, and some of these kids are because they are out on their own. They don't want to go back into a foster home, per se. And we try wherever we can to engage them with other services that are available. Beyond that, I'm not real sure what the differential is, but I can sure find out and get back to you.
Representative Slavik.
Representative Hayden, this is a really good bill. I think it's really good. And I have one that's turning 18 in a month. And so transition is kind of what we're going through, and that whole tug and pull of how much support, and he's a kid that's going to need a lot of support. And knowing that, when you see these kids, have they sort of come down to Ramsey County over on, I'm a Ramsey County rep, I represent both Washington and Ramsey, would they go down to the county building and then have to check in for case management then, and in order to qualify and to continue with the program? And how do you get 18-year-olds to do all that? Or maybe I'm curious how you, because you want to make sure they're staying healthy and having a great direction. And
if you get a representative, well, if you get a good answer on this one, let me know.
Maybe I'm searching for too much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pollock, I'll take a shot at this, and then Mary and others that do this work probably could talk about it. The young folks that are in the system typically have a social worker. They're typically someone, even if they're kind of in and out of services or in and out of foster care, they have some connection to the county, and that they would work directly with those case managers and social workers to start talking about kind of what are their options and what are the other things that they could do. I think that often on another bill, the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, often young people think the grass is green on the other side, and so they kind of take a shot at it, and then they find out it's not so green, or they may be difficult to place and might get sent. There was a young man that testified just the other day that he was from North Minneapolis, and they sent him to Duluth to represent the family's neck of the woods, and he just didn't know anybody there, and he just decided to leave Duluth, and then he was on his own. I think we want to kind of capture those young folks and make sure that they do have those alternatives and options, and that as they kind of bump their head along the way, they do so in a way that hopefully it doesn't kind of permanently impact their lives.
Okay, and then Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if this has a local impact note, and maybe somebody that's testifying there would know, because this would be increased cost to the counties, and typically the chair of the tax committee and the finance committee are able to request the local impact note. But without that, I mean, it's kind of hard to say what this would cost, and is this another mandate, unfunded mandate on the counties? I'm wondering if you've requested a local impact note through any of the other chairs.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the amended version of this was trying to take care of that issue, which the amended was worked out with the counties to require them to put together a plan on available funds. So we're not mandating them to do this work. We're saying if they have the availability and available funds to do so, and that was the work around that we had with the county. In Ramsey County, they do this to some level, and they do it to the amount of funds that they have available, and I think our testifier said that they really see this as the kind of last investment or the last installment of a large investment that they've made in these young people.
So then, Mr. Chair, thank you. So then the counties do have available funds for this? Is that what I'm hearing? The counties have extra money to do this, and they haven't been doing it already. I'm wondering how that works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, it is optional, as the bill spells it out with the language, and I think in human services so often there's so many things that we have to do, and frequently counties try to figure out how to best meet the needs of their particular constituencies and communities. And the case management part of it, the social workers working kind of informally with these kids, and from just anecdotally talking to some of the human services folks in some of the other counties, they do have kids come back and talk to that social worker because they've built a relationship with them, and they provide advice, and they sit down and talk with them and try to hook them up with different services. It's just kind of on an informal basis. Ramsey County, I'm not sure what prompted them to decide to invest in this, but they have decided that it is something that they want to do. We would love to be able to provide this service statewide for all of the kids who would request it, but for some counties, the funding is just not there. They may have decided to invest in other optional services. We do have a lot of mandates, and it leaves less and less money for us to put money into services that we would choose to do, but this is one of them that Ramsey chose, and another county may choose something else.
Chair, if I may, President Salty, one of the other kind of benefits to this is if children or young people age out of foster care and don't have a place to go, a place that they know that they've developed a relationship, they usually end up on the streets, and then in our system some other way, end up in jail, in the correction system, or end up in the kind of homeless system, if you will, where we're spending a lot of money working with those young folks. So I think it's also a diversion from them getting into that system and staying with people that they've developed a relationship with, and hopefully being encouraged to continue with their education, get the things that they need so that they can be a productive citizen.
I see no further discussion, so Representative Hayden renews his motion that House File 985 be recommended to pass and referred back to the Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the bill is passed and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And, we have a correction to the agenda for tomorrow. It says 6:30 p.m., but it will be shortly after session is over. So, with that, the meeting is adjourned.